Welcome to Here We Stand. I'm your regular host, Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice. It's November 14th, and that is the Ballad of the Green Mountain Boys. And people say, how come you like that song so much, Kev? Well, it's about the people who really launched the American Revolution, the Green Mountain Boys of Vermont. These guys were incredible. They started seizing crown courts and expelling crown judges. They set up their own courts. They invaded and took Fort Ticonderoga from the British without anyone telling them to do it. They really triggered a lot of the rebellion in New England. And in the original Vermont Constitution, it says, God made every man equal to his neighbor and has enjoined them to govern themselves by their own laws. The people best know their own wants and needs and therefore are best able to rule themselves. Well, that whole revolutionary creed is something that's still a threat, of course, in this era of COVID police state especially. They want you to forget about that. That's the principle here on Here We Stand, the voice of the Republic and the Resistance here every Sunday. Follow our work, murderbydecree.com, republicofkanata.ca. And before I get into today's show, I wanted to also remind you that one of the things that happened in Vermont when they set up their first assembly was they abolished slavery. It was the only state in America that never had slaves. The first constitution of Vermont, this is long before 1776, it provided for unrestricted vote to anyone regardless of property qualifications. They made all judges elected. They gave special protection to debtors, and they absolutely declared all slaves free the minute they entered the Vermont border, the only state in the Union ever to do that. So it shows you what happens when the people themselves are governing themselves. And like I say, that's something very important for all of us now, especially these days. Now, today in the show, we're going to look into how we need to recover our own history and to confront the false histories putting out there. We have to know our real history to know ourselves, and we have to reclaim ourselves to make our own history. And in that sense, there's two items in the news this week that we're going to be talking about, a little one and a big one having to do with false histories. First of all, at my old alma mater, University of British Columbia, a woman has been invited to speak. Her name's Laura Southern. She's kind of a celebrity, 26-year-old celebrity on the internet because she's a big genocide denier. She's going around saying Native children never died in Canada, there are no mass graves, etc. Although she was born the year we began this campaign, so I'm not sure on what basis she can make that claim besides mere opinion. But I've been asked to go to UBC and debate here, and in consultation with the Native elders in that community, I said, look, we're belittling the whole issue by having to defend it, by having to go down to gutter level and, you know, try to convince the world of something that is even being acknowledged by the people now who did it, the genocide. And so the response of the Native elders is to say, okay, then we'll show up. We will shut down this meeting. We won't let her speak. So it should be interesting this Wednesday at UBC, if you're in the area, University of British Columbia in Vancouver, go out to room 155 in the Irving K. Barber Center. That's the main library. This Wednesday at 5 p.m. should be fun. Second bigger item is the people who perpetrated the crime are once again covering up the mass grave. Now, you know about the one in Kamloops. That was a notorious site where Queen Elizabeth took 10 children away and they were never seen again. It was also a big experimental center run by the Catholics and the Anglicans where a lot of children died through drug testing experiments, for one thing, for good old Pfizer and the drug companies telling you to shove a needle in their arm now. They were using the residential schools like Kamloops, but also the one in Brantford, where we conducted a dig, interestingly, 10 years ago this month, October, November 2011. I was invited by 9 elders to come and help dig there. We found bones. They turned out to be human after being analyzed at the Smithsonian. Nobody reported it. No interest whatsoever from the world media. I think the Mohawk Community Paper was the only one who reported that. You can see all of that if you go to murderbydecree.com. We wrote a special report about it after on page 347. If you go to murderbydecree.com, just go into the text of my book that you won't find in any library in Canada because it's systematically taken out. But you can read that report and see now how the very people covered it up 10 years ago are now saying they're going to do a, quote, dig like the one in Kamloops. But, of course, they're not letting anyone in to see it. the police who buried the children, the RCMP, are the ones investigating, along with the puppet Native chiefs who shut down our effort 10 years ago, invited by the traditional elders of the Mohawk, Grand River Mohawks. So those are two examples this week of how, if you allow the criminals to write their own history, you'll never know the truth. And without the truth of who we are, we can't know who we are now. We have to know our history. And it's interesting, when I mentioned the thing about Vermont, Pennsylvania, when they ratified their first revolutionary constitution, a lot like Vermont, they made it where people could actually nullify decisions of the state legislature and even the state Supreme Court. We had an example of that recently. If you go back a few years on our archived shows here at bbsradio.com/herewestand, you'll see an interview with a couple of folks from Grant County in Pennsylvania. In 2018, they nullified a decision by the state to allow groundwater fracking to be dumped in their community and pollute their water supply. Both Republican and Democrat voters got together, nullified the decision of the state to allow the fracking water to be dumped there by something called a home rule law, where people can nullify decisions of the wider legislature if they don't agree with it. So that's a very revolutionary idea. We've talked about the establishment of our own Republic of Canada jurisdiction, but one step towards that is you set up a local assembly and you say, we are not going to agree to any law unless we get to debate it first and make changes to it and nullify it if we don't agree with it. In other words, we have veto power over any laws coming down from the courts, the government, whoever. That's the original idea of the American Revolution. Now, of course, other states were against that idea because they were run by slave owners and they didn't want the people, you know, ratifying their own and taking charge of their own lives. That's why in America now you have a president who's like the king, a Senate who's like the House of Lords to nullify any congressional decisions they don't like, and the Electoral College and an appointed judiciary. All of that remnants of kind of the slave-owning aristocracies take over the American Revolution. But the seed, the germ of revolution persists in any Republican notion of the people governing themselves. So I wanted to share that today. And in the latter half of the show, I'm going to play to you a really interesting interview I did this last week from a brother down in America. He's part of our common law allied movement. He's from the South. And we got into a really interesting discussion where I did some self-disclosure and going into deeper why people have to rule themselves before they can rule society in their own name. And looking at kind of the psychological factors and others, that things that can hold us back. So I hope you stay tuned now and listen to the last half of the show when we get there. But before that, I want to share some things that are coming out of a couple of books I wrote. But I had one of our listeners on the West Coast, Darnell. She said, Kev, please on the air, talk more about the 1837 rebellion in Canada, because we don't know a lot about it. We were never taught about it in our history books. And, you know, we need that background because we did try to set up a republic in Canada in 1837 in both Quebec and Ontario, and it got defeated. And we're living under the legacy of that now. As a matter of fact, it's so possible for the COVID state to work so well in Canada because a monarchy and the church were given absolute authority. It was like an autocracy from day one in Canada. Still to this day, most of the laws are never even passed by Parliament, but by order in council, a few guys sitting around a room and drafting a law. So I wanted to go into answer Darnell's request. I'm going to read something out of for the next few minutes from my book, and it's kind of a satirical look at Canadian history. It's called 1497 and so on, A History of White People in Canada, or the Caucasian Healing Fund. And I call that because these smartasses in the government, when the truth of the genocide in residential schools came out, they set up a thing called the Aboriginal Healing Fund, which is what, of course, their answer to how you deal with genocide. You throw some money at the survivors. So I think it's a more appropriate title to be called the Caucasian Healing Fund, because frankly, I think us folks who did the crime are the ones who need the healing, don't you think? So in this book, one of the chapters is giving the background to what led to the 1837 rebellion, and it's called The 7 Years' War Over Nothing, Really. And this was the war between France and England that really gave England control of Canada. None of the four German Georges who sat on the English throne ever mastered the English language, although they sat on the throne for well over a century, which is kind of funny, don't you think? King George III was the worst of the lot, a nasty, bigoted little creep who was also a genuine nutbar who wandered the halls of his London palace at night, screaming orders in German to imaginary people. No wonder he lost the American colonies, huh? Well, to make matters even worse for the Brits, the furs from Canada were running out by 1756, and those uppity English colonists around Boston were starting to rant about their inalienable rights and threatening to dump all the imported British tea into the ocean, making it quite undrinkable, even for Americans. So the Crown needed something to get everybody to forget about their knighty king and unite around God and country again, and so, bingo, wag the dog, along came the Seven Years' War. The French lost that one, big time. They ended up surrendering most of the land they'd stolen all over the world to those other bandits, the British, in places like India and the Caribbean. Sacrebleu, pas de empire! And then to top off their bad luck streak, a few years later their own King Louis got his head chopped off by more revolting masses, which wasn't a bad thing at all. Not the best of time for French imperialists. But right after that war, the Indians around what's now Ontario who were left alive were given by a very beneficent British crown the kind of choice empires love to offer their targets, surrender your land or die. Now that's quite sporting when you think of it, giving the savages a choice like that. Well done, I say. But remnants of Indians were only some of the headaches facing the Brits who had now taken over Canada. A few Anglican bishops, colonial governments, and fat merchant bankers ran the country. Hey, just like now. And they divided the country into Lower Canada, being filled with French, hence lower, and Upper Canada, where the Anglos lived, and hence over and above. This little clique of governing fops was derogatorily known as the Family Compact, especially by their political nemesis, a bald-headed Scotsman with a fiery tongue and very bad manners named William Lyon Mackenzie. He and his constituents of small farmers eventually got so pissed off at the royal fops that they took up arms against them. Well, sort of. Just when most Canadians thought there wouldn't be any more wars, that's when the rebellion broke out. In 1837, one in Toronto, and of course, a similar one of equal time in Montreal. It's important to note that the 1837 rebellion, which, by the way, was participated in by my great-great-great grandfather, Philip Bennett, a farmer and blacksmith west of what's now London, Ontario, in the farming land around Watford. And we've even got a family diary describing his adventures trying to overthrow the crown. Thank you, Grandpa. Well, William Lyon Mackenzie and his rebels faced a formidable opponent in the person of Sir Peregrine Maitland, a corpulent aristocrat who ran all of what was then Canada, stretching from around Yonge Street to the farmlands 100 miles west of Mimico. The whole colony was not only run by the Family Compact, but the single governor of the entire colonies. And the Family Compact, you know, bore not too much resemblance to modern-day Tories, other than that they were inbred, narrowly imperialistic, and read nothing but the Globe and Mail and the Bible. On second thought, perhaps they did bear some resemblance to today's conservatives. And they also ran the church, of which only the Anglican variety was allowed to operate, and they owned most of the land, the banks, the law courts, and the taverns that were allowed to operate in Toronto. Well, the farmers were routinely outraged, just as farmers are today, over issues like freight rates and ethanol prices. And three times they elected William Lyon Mackenzie to the legislature, but three times the Family Compact threw him out. Bishop Strachan, who ran the colony, head of the Anglican Church there, threw up Mackenzie with the famous words, "To hell with legality, toss him out." That means out in Scottish. Well, upper and lower Canada were ripe for a revolution, and if a vote had been taken, and if you included the Indians, there would have been a landslide in favor of war, which was unusual for Canada. Unfortunately, the vote at that time was restricted to only rich English-speaking white men, similar to the guys who had forged the American Constitution. Well, like I mentioned, my great-great-great-grandfather Philip Bennett in rural Ontario picked up the family flintlock and joined Mackenzie in the great endeavor of being an inspired Republican. Actually, Philip's wife was a bit of a battle axe, and according turned a family legend, and Phil got out of the house as much as he could. When he left in December 1837 in the middle of winter, his wife was extremely angry because he took the only gun they owned, leaving her defenseless against marauding wolves and Indians and missionaries. Anyway, the rebels lost. About the same time in Montreal, Louis-Joseph Papineau, who was a lawyer, offered to lead the rebellion there pro bono. He did a little bit better than Mackenzie, defeating the British at the Battle of Saint-Denis. But in two successive battles over the following 3 weeks, the British dispersed the rebels and reestablished the sovereignty of the crown and the stiff upper lip. Well, one of the more noteworthy facts about William Lyon Mackenzie was that he was kind of nuts. As a result, everyone, farmers and townspeople alike, considered him normal compared to the rest of the crown colony at the time. Now, he was known as Little Mac, as opposed to the later Big Mac, or the Canada's first prime minister, John A. Macdonald, who just happened to be a railway lobbyist for the CPR and a drunkard as well. But Little Mac decided on the eve of the revolution, instead of storing up treasuries in heaven, he would store up gunpowder and muskets in his basement. And at the same time, Papineau, the Montreal lawyer, sent a lengthy brief to Mackenzie, deposing that whereas he was prepared, notwithstanding or precluding the necessary formalities, and not limiting the generality of the foregoing to act, promulgate, and proceed, and deemed to be ready, that the case had come to declare hostilities. In other words, if it pleased the court, he would move to strike. Having no legal background and being 5 feet in height, Little Mac had both a lack of legal verbiage with which to respond, and he also had an inferiority complex. Besides, he hated waiting for people, especially legally trained French Canadians. So Little Mac gathered a small army at a pub known as Montgomery's Tavern, north of York, which is now around Yonge and Bloor Street in downtown Toronto. It used to be hilly fields and forests at the time. And as it turned out, Sir Peregrine Maitland happened to own Montgomery's Tavern, where the rebels were gathering. So he was aware of all of Little Mac's plans. And unfortunately, or fortunately, Sir Peregrine had also learned of Papineau's plot in Quebec, and he had already dispatched all of his troops to go crush that rebellion. So the local armory stood open and unguarded, as was Sir Peregrine himself. Little Mac immediately incited his troops to action, with the objective of seizing the governor, occupying Fort Henry, flying in the face of the family compact as well as the British monarchy, and declaring a Canadian republic. Well, with Little Mac, they were led by a former Dutch army officer named Van Egmond, who had fought with Napoleon and had been severely reprimanded for it. They had marched halfway down Yonge Street, somewhere now around the Bloor Street Viaduct, and they were suddenly confronted by a dozen figures approaching through the early morning mist. Well, the scant handful of locals had taken up arms to defend Sir Peregrine, the crown, and the established order. Now, confronting the rebels, they let go a volley of musket shot at the opposing farmers and immediately turned tail and ran away. Well, Mackenzie's men returned their fire, but then tragedy struck, snatching defeat, or at least stalemate, from the jaws of victory. Colonel Van Egmond, in the best Fusilier tradition, had ordered the front rank to kneel, providing the second rank with a simultaneous field of fire. Unfortunately, the colonel had not had the time to instruct the men in basic infantry tactics. Seeing the front rank drop, those in the second rank concluded that those in the front had all been killed by the Tory fusillade, and immediately most of Little Mac's army turned and ran back in the direction of Unionville. And that was pretty well the end of the Upper Canada Rebellion of 1837. Sir Peregrine's government exacted a terrible revenge on the revolting Canadians by deporting 100 of them, sentencing them to life in Australia, which was judged to be a fate worse than capital punishment. And two of the rebel leaders, Peter Matthews and Samuel Lount, were actually hanged, although Mackenzie managed to flee to the United States, which he viewed as marginally preferable to the gallows. My ancestor, Philip Annett, somehow managed to escape and return to his farm, deciding that there are some things in the affairs of men worse than putting up with one's own wife, however ballistic. Canada was launched down a road over which historians are still divided, some viewing it as law, order, and good government under the crown, while others consider it a road of servile dependency. Still others say that the descriptions really amount to the same thing. And in that note, in the next few minutes, I'm going to bring it up to the present to talk about modern times, more modern times. Because right after World War II, the Brits actually vanished. The amount of British control over the economy and politics really began to subside. The Brits may have gone bankrupted by World War II, stripped of their colonies, and just generally out of it, but oh, say, can you see who took over after John Bullshit left? America got its grasping hands around our balls quicker and more completely than the Brits ever had, thanks to the post-war economic boom and a flood of Yankee takeover investment into our economic entrails. Over three-quarters of our trade was with America by 1950, and all our manufacturing was getting bought up by Wall Street. So after that, none of our politicians ever dared to go against, do anything against Washington but jump when they were told to. Actually, that isn't quite true. There was one Canadian prime minister who did sort of stand up to the Yankees once. Old John Diefenbaker, a die-hard Brit-loving Tory from Saskatchewan, who in 1962, as prime minister, told John F. Kennedy that he couldn't station those darn Bomarc missiles in Canada. Like, take off, you Catholic hoser. Well, Jack Kennedy didn't like being denied anything by anybody. Just ask Marilyn Monroe if you're a psychic. So El Presidente told the CIA to get rid of that inconvenient John Diefenbaker, and the spooks did so, of course, during the 1963 Canadian election. They massively funded his liberal opponent, Lester B. Pearson, circulated media rumors that old Diefenbaker was senile and a closet alcoholic, and employed other methods we can't describe in front of the children. Well, sadly, John Diefenbaker didn't have any subsequent imitators. So in our nice sort of way, we Canucks settled down comfortably after the war to become resource whores for the Americans and for any other nation that paid us even a pittance, dutifully shipping off all our raw logs and water and oil and uranium and jobs to the United States and Japan and now China. We didn't want to cause any upset or controversy, after all. That'd be very un-Canadian, don't you know? But something in this big prostitution didn't feel quite right to us, so a mild sort of nationalist impulse took over during the 1960s on both sides of the English and French divide. I haven't mentioned the French recently, but hold on to your tortillas. That Francophone nationalist movement known as the Parti Québécois started gaining ground in Quebec by the late 1960s, which was no surprise, really, when you consider the corrupt morass of Catholic church-run governments up until then in Quebec. Suddenly, the Separatist Party got about 35% of the vote in favor of, gasp, outright separation from our lovely old Canada. What the heck, came our media hype howl, reject our wonderful British heritage? The mere suggestion of Quebec separating from the rest of the country made us Anglos kind of fighting mad as we can get. After all, we had whipped French butt at the Plains of Abraham in 1763. And it caused many of us to pull out our faded maple leaves and wave them around a bit. On the other hand, if you are like me, you are kind of hankering to see the Parti Quebec win. You know, I mean, like a lot of English people thought, well, why would they want to end our beautiful relationship together that went back to all those throat-slitting, bayonet-gouging days? But thinking of it all, people in Quebec really were just kind of mouthing nationalism. They didn't actually want to separate. They were just playing the game the way Aboriginal leaders do, just to get more money. But of course, at the time, it led to something which little Justin Trudeau is imitating now, that his dad, Pierre Trudeau, did, and that was to declare the War Measures Act. Because around 1970, some of the wealthy crowd in Montreal got panicky when the nationalist PQ party continued to climb in the polls. And they said to the boys in red, hey, do something about this quick. So voila! That year, a convenient and tiny band of armed mercenaries, sprinkled with paid provocateurs, calling itself the FLQ, the Front pour la Libération du Québec, showed up out of nowhere and kidnapped the Quebec cabinet minister, Pierre Laporte, and a British trade diplomat named James Cross. Well, things got out of hand quickly, which happens with contrived scenarios. Somebody shot Pierre Laporte through his head and stuffed him in the trunk of a car. The guy had strong Montreal mob connections, but, of course, nobody ever mentioned that. And so, enter the scene, a guy called the Turdo, Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau, a Jesuit-educated snob and kitty molester. Pierre promptly called out all the troops, literally, arrested without due process lots of Canadians, and trashed all those bleeding-heart liberals who are worried about such things as civil liberties and a fair trial. Welcome to the War Measures Act. Well, that went on for a few months in Canada, not just in Quebec, but elsewhere. But The whole thing did have its funny side, since the Mounties were involved. The boys in red, not known for their artistic sensibilities or mental dexterity, once gathered up a subversive suspect's entire collection of art books on Cubism because, you know, Cuba. Cubism. Duh. And that's the RCMP for you. Their top officials are now getting sued by their own female officers some today for sexual harassment and on-the-job rape. So go figure. Anyway, it all goes to show you that Canada, whether then or now, isn't necessarily the most boring place on earth. And now Pierre Trudeau's debonair son, Justin, has got himself made our prime minister simply because of his last name and his Q profile. What? Dynastic successions here in Canada? No. Tabernacle. Which, by the way, folks, is a swear word in France. It means tabernacle, and you're not supposed to make fun of the Catholic Church. So you never say tabernacle if you're in Quebec. Okay? Well, that was our little history lesson for today. Real history, that happened, then you were never taught. Murderbydecree.com, republicofcanada.ca. And now we're going to listen to that part of the interview, a latter part of the interview that I promised. And I hope you enjoy it. It does disclose some things about me and other things that you probably never heard about. And self-disclosure, as I talk about, is very important. If we're going to start the revolution in our own life, in our own mind and heart, and let it spread outward like a great flowing stream of life. This is Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice. It's great to be with you. Watch for my column this Wednesday, where we'll be reporting on the debacle at UBC, whether the genocide denier gets to do it in the face of Native protests. We'll have a report on that definitely next Sunday, but go to republicofcanada.ca. If you look in the headline, you'll see Annett's Weekly, and that's my weekly column I've published every week now. So here's the interview. Stay strong, stay clear. Love you all. See you all soon.
But do you see things picking up again? You know, you mentioned the protests, and you know that's something we've seen for almost 4 months now. Various countries throughout the world, particularly Europe, but Canada too, and obviously Australia. It doesn't seem to be making that much of a change. And you mentioned that you know people are looking for what else to do besides protest, and I feel the same way. It's like it seems like I'm broadcasting in a cave sometimes, you know, it's with the censorship that's going on. What are some actionable things you think people can do? Maybe they are protesting, but they want to do something more too.
To me, it's not so much what we do, because that follows from who we are, right? Who we are, like, this is providing a mirror for us to really look at ourselves. And what's happening right now is really not any different than the way the system normally is. It's just striking a lot more of us. And we've all profited by it. We grew up in it. We're attached to it in ways we don't understand, and that's why it's hard to fight it. We all have an innate loyalty to the very thing that is oppressing us, right? So we have to do some deep reflection on that fact. And you can't create an alternative unless you've laid the axe to the root and learned how to sever ties on every level with the old thing. It's like, when I used to do divorce counseling with people, you know, it takes like several years for the old emotional ties to fade. And with a lot of people, they don't. There's this kind of codependency you have with old relationships that are destructive and toxic. So what you have to do with them and with your connection with the wider is visualize literally cutting the cords, cutting the ties, and learning what it really means to be autonomous. And that's innate, and it's not something that can be taught to you or you can find anywhere but within yourself. But, I find on a practical level, when we say, well, look, this whole system rests on our taxes, our involvement, our going into the store and buying stuff, how do we create alternatives to that? And it only can start in your community, right? But you need your mind free first, and your mind free is freed only in the course of fighting. It's kind of a catch-22. You can't be free until you fight, but you can't fight until you're free, right? And so it's kind of a back-and-forth process all the time.
You know? Wow. Yeah, that's some deep stuff there, Mr. Annett. And if we could, I actually am curious about your divorce counseling you did. How long did you do that for?
Well, I was a minister, and after that, when I didn't have a pulpit anymore, I still did a lot of counseling with people on that. Not just divorce, a lot of trauma counseling and just everything. You know, worked with a lot of survivors of sexual assault and torture at a young age. And it's strange. The patterns are so similar. When you find somebody's been really traumatized and somebody goes through even like the death of a pet, you know, or it's the same kind of inability to relate to it. And you create all sorts of deceptions where you don't have to face your own pain and loss. Right. And I find it really similar. Right.
Mm-hmm. And with the divorce counseling, what did you find was the most common problem for those couples, and how did they fix that if they could?
Not knowing themselves, not knowing each other, marrying really young, usually because of pressure from other people, and not understanding, you know, it takes, I know from, because I married very young and that ended, and you don't really know yourself very well. It's hard to communicate. It's hard to express feelings, especially men in this culture. And all of that adds up to kind of a blame game where people are always pointing fingers. And I say, well, the first finger you should point to is look at yourself. Look at, take, everything is 50%, everything in a relationship, right? And maturity means taking responsibility for your own decisions and your own self, not saying, well, if only she was different, I'd be better. Or vice versa, right? That's often what people do. They just say, it's somebody else, you know, we're being oppressed by this COVID police state. No, we've also created this COVID police state, right? Let's look at how we've created and how we can, we then have power over a situation. If you say, I've created something, I can detach from it. But if you're just a permanent victim, you can't do anything except be a victim. I'm oppressed, right? Mm-hmm. Same in a relationship. You know, if something is always being done to you, you have no control over it, right? You're just a battered kid, right?
It's something I've noticed, Mr. Annett, traveling. And I noticed that if you want, this is my contention, if you want people to like you or open up to you while traveling or just strangers, don't talk about yourself at all. Just keep asking them questions.
Oh, yeah.
And I found that's been really, really helpful for me. But it also brings to mind in this acting book, it's called Audition, when I was taking acting classes in college. And it said one of the things that humans compete most about with each other is who has suffered more. And and like, there's always a competition to
that's true,
to see who's suffered the most. So what you're kind of saying is, if you can be aware of when you're doing that, and just put a cap on it and just see what listen to what the other person or the other party is saying, that's going to take you.
Listening is really difficult, because active listening, they say, is to neutralize your need to immediately respond with your own opinion, because don't forget where that's coming from. None of us have really been ever valued in our life, to be honest. We're all struggling for recognition and love and being upheld, and to say, yeah, your life matters, your opinion matters, right? Because everywhere you go, it doesn't. You know, the movie star matters, the politician matters, you know, some authority figure matters, but we don't. So naturally people want to talk about themselves, but once they've been recognized, then they open up. And I found, for example, what really opened up this whole story in Port Alberni when I was a minister, the whole thing about the genocide, was I began to talk about myself from the pulpit. I didn't talk about God. I didn't talk about higher stuff or the way you should all be. I just said, here's what happened this week for me. This is what I'm struggling with, right? This is what I've learned about what happened just down the road in this residential school. And when you self-disclose, that allows other people to as well. It's like in an AA group or a 12-step group, or you got to disclose from the get. You got to be ruthlessly honest, and then other people can be too, right? So it's that whole process, you know, building on that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well said there. And did you find that many, and I don't think this has a whole lot to do with your own ability to counsel, but as far as the couples that were getting counseled, did they succeed in fixing their problems, or was it one way or another, statistically?
I'm not sure, because people don't hang around. You know, you never see them again, no hear from them. I know people in my congregation, it helped, but it wasn't so much what I did for them as what they did for themselves. And working on a relationship or anything that's real, it takes a lot of work. There's no easy answers. There's no 3-minute fix. And a lot of people don't do that because we live in a lazy culture that we expect easy answers, quick information. We don't understand who we are, and that life is uncertain, filled with a lot of pain and risk. And it's better to drug ourselves up to ignore those hard facts of life, right? So I can't give you a statistic. Sure. I do know that I it's not so much answers as questions I pose to people, right? Did you think about this? Or have you looked at this? And they often found that opening to some degree, right?
You mentioned you married young. Is there an ideal age to get married, would you say?
No, I think later is better because you have more life experience. Statistically, when people have a second or third marriage, like when they're in their 40s, 50s, 60s, even a marriage, it lasts longer because you've been around the block. You know what to expect. You don't have, like with me, I got married because of a very love-deprived childhood I had. And any woman who showed interest in me, I said, great, let's get married. Come on, I've got to grab onto you quick, right? That was my experience, right? And naturally, it was the wrong basis to love someone. But unfortunately, Judy, my first wife, came from the same place. So we kind of met in that place for a while, but then we realized it was kind of built on sand and we parted amiably, right?
But, okay. Wow, fascinating. Do you want to, or could you expand on that at all, your childhood and what you mean by that? Or we could do it in another episode too, if you'd like.
Oh, I don't mind. I was, well, you know, my parents were the product of the Depression and World War II, where they hadn't learned, you know, they lived with so much suffering and scarcity that everything was about creating material security. You get this out of baby boomers like me. Their parents were all into security, all into material things. That's why you had the 60s generation reacting against all that, right? But my mother was very narcissistic. My father kind of indifferent to who I was. So I had to go my own way. But at a young age, I had bronchial asthma. I spent about a year in a oxygen tent in a hospital. And unfortunately, in the hospital, I was badly abused, badly molested by staff. And I only uncovered that when I was doing my own therapy, my own working with other survivors, that I realized that I was one myself, right? I think that's why I was intuitively drawn to people who had been through that kind of institutionalized torture. So it kind of opened up things about that. And I was, you know, very much, I still am, someone who tends to suppress my own feelings and needs for the sake of others. And that's, you know, you got to find a balance like anything in life, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. That's...
in a nutshell.
Yeah, it's deep stuff there, Mr. Anna. I did not know that. Do you expand on that in your own books? Because I haven't read them all yet. Because you do have a lot. You have, what, 27 books?
No, 17. I think, or is it 18?
Lost track. 18 or 18 books? Yeah, 17.
Books. And okay. I've written a few different versions of biographies where I look at things from different angles. And in one of them, I go into detail about that being held in Sick Children's Hospital in Toronto, where they were getting a lot of money from the MKUltra program to do experimentation there. So who knows the extent of what they tried to work on me, but I mean, I know that a lot of children went through that. There's a lot of people, and as somebody who's being institutionally tortured like that, I can almost spot in someone when I see them, there's just a feeling that they've been through the same thing. You know, survivors have that natural kind of, sense about each other. They're drawn to each other for that reason. That's why I think we can be great help to one another once we get out of our fear that we're always going to be alone, which is what you feel when you've been through a lot of trauma at a young age, right?
Yeah, I think that's one of my biggest fears. Perhaps most people's, would you say?
Yeah, really?
Being alone, yeah.
Well, I enjoy it. Now that I'm in my 60s, I enjoy my solitude. Like, that started for me in my 50s. That's something really wonderful about discovering more of who you are. And, you know, I think our best company is ourselves, you know, that there's just so much what another person can do, or even children can do for you, right? Your own children, that at some point somebody described life as a long loneliness, right? Where, you know, but learning to live with that, learning to live with the incurable illness called mortality, right? And going beyond it, like I don't like the term healing, because that like means going back to a status quo. We want to transcend and transform our pain into something higher and better all the time. We want it like Martin Luther King had this phrase about raising America up. We don't want equality only. We want to raise the whole moral tone of the country up, right? So that this racism and genocide and all this stuff doesn't happen anymore. So that's how I view individual growth too, right? But we got to keep raising ourselves up all the time, Pastor Fears.
That's a great lens, I think, especially with regards to what you just said with kind of race relations. It's like people are always wanting to go back to this equity line that's, you know, somewhere down here, like the status quo equity line, whatever you want to say. But, you know, it's better to evolve and transcend to a greater state of being, right? It's like the quote, you can't fix problems at the same level of consciousness that they were created at, kind of similar.
That's a beautiful quote, and it's true, right? You know, and anyway, whose notion of equality are we dealing with? Like, it's a very formalistic notion of equality. Equal treatment before the law was America's notion of what race relations should be. Okay, and like when Lincoln passed the 13th Amendment to do away, well, it didn't really do away with slavery legally in America, because you can still legally have slaves in prison. But
yeah. Great point.
In order to get the compromise of all the wings to get the pass, they had to agree that, no, we don't believe in racial equality, just equality before the law. You know, and America's kind of stayed there, right? As long as you're treated well before the law, it doesn't matter what else has happened in your life. I mean, it's bogus, right? But we need to transcend that limitation, right?
Yeah, and even if it is bogus, if only that were true, you know, I think the society would be a lot better.
Yeah, if only, like, we lived up to our own words, right? The official words.
Yeah, precisely, exactly. Do you foresee our current situation going kinetic in the form of an extended armed conflict or a secession, either in your country or in my country, or both? Maybe there's going to be a dual country secessionist movement. I don't know. It's hard to say. But yeah, do you think it'll go kinetic? Because right now it's just informational war.
Oh, I think it's going to get a lot worse before it gets better, because you've got a rising new power in the world, not simply China, which geopolitically is the rising power, but that normally means war. I could see America and China at war within the next 5 to 10 years easily. But on a bigger level, the whole corporatocracy that's taken over the planet, that's more powerful than governments, you know, a system that achieves power never relinquishes it. That's the law of history, right? Once a new power has entered the world, they will go until they're either destroyed or they totally tyrannize everything, take it all over. But something that big also has a built-in weakness. And if, you know, like in nature, the less diversity you have, the more fragile the ecosystem is, right? And the same politically, too. The more tyranny and totalitarianism you get, the more unstable it is, and that's why they have to repress and repress all the time, right? So I see it blowing up even worse than it is now. It can't help it. We're in a big pressure cooker situation, right?
Yeah, and I heard people describe our current situation as a pressure cooker, even going back to last year, just using kind of big American cities and the lockdown, you know, quite literally being like a human pressure cooker, right? And I actually found some notes that I wrote last year when I was studying your work, Mr. Anna. I wanted to share. Hopefully we could go over them. And I got here, speaking of China, with regards to China, Richard Fadden, head of Canadian Intelligence Services, said Chinese government had been systematically infiltrating Canadian government on the West Coast, specifically the resource ministries. After making the statement, he resigned shortly after and never spoke of it since. Trudeau, one of the first things he did was remove all restrictions on Chinese investments in Canada. Foreign Investment Protection Act was passed, which was initiated by, Harbor, which allows China to station their own troops on Canadian soil, to protect their own investments. And then go ahead.
The Harper, but Harper means the previous government, the Stephen Harper's conservative Harper. Government,
okay.
Actually brought in. And so both the conservatives and the liberals backed this foreign investment protection, okay. Takes over.
And then I got the SNC-Lavalin affair in quotations. China is after liquid natural gas sites. There's almost a direct track of where natives go missing on the Highway of Tears. George Brown, Aboriginal RCMP Mountie, officers said first reports of missing bodies were all missing organs. One of the Chinese generals responsible for organ trafficking in Chinese prisons was sitting on the board of directors of liquid natural gas companies.
Yeah, PetroChina, which is it's owning most of the province now. And all of that is true. It's being validated time and again, reporters, cops, Native people themselves, the eyewitnesses. So it's just the sign of how it's changing, right? The takeover.
Yeah. Wow. Scary stuff there when you got basically the head of your, I guess that would be CIA, right? Or FBI, Canadian. Well, you guys have them kind of combined a little bit right there with the Canadian intelligence.
CSIS, they call it, Canadian Security Intelligence Service. It really combines both the FBI and the CIA, but there's no equivalent. There's no, like in America, you have congressional oversight over both.
Sure. Yeah.
There is no parliamentary over. They're not answered. They only have to give to the Solicitor General in Ottawa the information they think he should see. So it's like the Vatican. It's a secret society, basically, right?
Yeah. It's like almost like cartel intelligence or mafia intelligence, you know, where they're
right
only responsible to themselves. Pretty ridiculous stuff there. But anything you want to add there on China, Trudeau, Richard Fadden, Canadian intelligence services, liquid natural gas sites?
I think it very much ties into the attempt to cover up the mass grave sites of the children, the destruction in Kamloops, the Pope going there, because the last thing they want is for graves to be open generally, because there are a lot of graves there that are present-day usage. A lot of the native people that go missing are in graves very similar to what you find in residential schools, in fact, very near. So you can't have a general investigation or you might uncover more recently interred bodies the Chinese and others. So, you know, they have to put a lid on the whole thing. It's why cops never investigate child abuse very much, because it might lead to somebody in government or some judge or, you know, they put a clamp on that to protect the whole system and the people in it who are profiting off it, right?
Yeah, it reminds me of a quote, which I don't think I was meant to necessarily hear, but it was from someone quite high up on a military base in the Pacific. And they basically said, it was kind of in the midst of the Me Too movement. And he's saying, we got people worried about touching somebody's shoulder. And meanwhile, there's blatant evidence of child abuse, and they don't do a single thing about it. They're more worried about somebody touching a woman's shoulder.
Well, it's part of a whole strategy of estranging human beings from one another. You know, you've got to be afraid of each other. But it's true. When I gave a talk once in Manhattan, and a cop was in the audience, and he got up and he said, you know, in this city and generally all over America, you have to rape a kid 10 or 20 times before it goes to trial. And people go, what? And he said, yeah, there's no percentage in it because it's so common. And, you know, like everybody knows that. Everybody who's a cop knows that. It's not considered a crime to rape a child. Like in Canada, the another thing the Harper Conservative government is, they lowered the mandatory sentencing for child rape from 5 to 1 year. So all you have to do is, the most you get is 1 year in prison for raping a child and you're out in 2 months. I mean, that's a lesser offense than owning a marijuana plant. So yeah. It shows you how important child protection is in the culture.
Yeah, it's just becoming too obvious. This, you know, the whole drug war is just a total gambling racket, is what it is.
Yeah.
But I have a question here, Mr. Anna, because I just, you know, for some time when I was younger, I wanted to be a teacher, but now I know I probably would be miserable and or fired for showing the wrong information, wrong information. How do you get the message like this to the youth? And, you know, because a lot of it's dark, so, you know, maybe a couple layers to this question. Like, what age should we introduce such information to them? And more generally, how do we educate them in such a way to get them interested in this sort of stuff?
Well, you know, thinking of what kids see on television, the level of violence and traumatization that happens, talking to them in a very human way about this happened to your friends is very important because it can protect them too. So Like, for example, when I did get invited into high schools in Canada, I would speak to grade 11 and 12 classes who were doing Aboriginal studies, and my best reception was from 15, 16, 17-year-olds, you know, who intuitively know this stuff, you know, and they get so excited. As a matter of fact, I spoke in a Catholic school once. The next thing they do is they went down that Sunday and picketed their own church about child rape. But, you know, like these Catholic kids were just ready to go. They just needed the knowledge because they hated wearing uniforms and all the strict catechisms and prayers and everything. So you find tremendous response, especially these days when young people have access to so much information. But it can numb you down psychically. It psychically numbs you when you get too much horror dumped into you. You can't respond anymore, right? And so it's a fine line, but I don't think there should be, I mean, within limits, I think anyone who's a teenager should know this stuff, right? Children, that's a different issue, right? But we try to do that all the time to get this into the school curriculum and that, and just being on your show, you know, is one way to do it, right?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Anna. Yeah, I appreciate that. I have a pretty wide, I would say, swath of demographics, depending on the channel and depending on the what iteration of termination I'm on. It's something I've thought about, too, because, you know, just history education in general, in my experience, it was very cookie cutter. You know, you'd hear the same few events, right? It was like in World War II, it was like the D-Day, Battle of Berlin. And that's World War II, you know. And then Black history, you got Rosa Parks, MLK. Barely even hear about Malcolm X, let alone anything else. And there's just so much that is just completely passed over. I'm guessing just because it's state mandated. But I don't know. It's hard to judge people because that's their, like, you know, I'm thinking of like some history teachers that I really liked. You know, it's like, why didn't they just at least hint at some of this stuff? Was it because they didn't know or because they were that concerned about keeping their job? You know, it's tough to say, but I was thinking about it through that perspective because I was just thinking, you know, if I was a history teacher, I could do a better job than most of these people by just showing them the right documentaries every day, you know, and not even doing homework, right?
So be a history teacher in your own way to as many young people as you can. You don't need a degree to do it, you know. I believe really strongly in that informal education, teaching one another the truth about stuff, right? And there's nothing more important than to reach young minds and stimulate those minds, right? Do you know that before public education, there was a higher literacy rate in America than after? You know?
Wow. No, yeah. I did not know that.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. People were self-educated in small towns and villages, and they read voluminously. You know, so, and then that changed when you get into the meat grinder assembly line education system, which is oriented more and more towards turning on workers who don't think.
The lowest common denominator, would you say?
Well, it was a definite policy in the early 20th century. Rockefeller funded what was called the General Education Board, and it funded a lot of the universities, colleges, and school system. They refashioned the curriculum away from liberal arts thinking to vocational trades. And Rockefeller said, John D. Rockefeller, the original, said, "I need workers who work, not think." That was a direct quote, right? So you find that today very much vocationally oriented, you know. So it's obvious, right, that you got to go back to people's innate education and understanding. You know, people teach themselves once they believe in themselves, right?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's a great way to put it here. And just wrapping up our show this evening, Mr. Anna, another great one I think we had. Got your Lauren Southern on Wednesday, hopefully, unless you get canceled again, which is maybe a probability at this point. But, I'm really happy you got on that because she's got a huge, huge platform, and she's definitely one of those – I don't know how old she is, but she's one of those people that I think thinks they know what they're talking about more often than they actually do.
She's 25 or 26. I told her in an email, I was very polite and everything. I said, "Well, I'm not sure how much you can comment on it because you were born the year that I got fired and started this whole campaign." So, like, I think she has a big following because she's saying what a lot of people in their anger and racism want to hear. And she's attractive and she plays on that like any movie star. And it's unfortunate people are drawn in by that. But the point is that she is out and out doing Holocaust denial. And that, you know, just saying their suffering didn't happen. Like if I said to her, if she was raped when she was a child and I said, prove it publicly, I'm going to debate you on whether you were, that happened to you as a child. No one would dare to do that, but she can do it to a whole culture of people. She can say to Native people, your suffering didn't happen. And those children lying in the ground are actually there. I mean, it's unconscionable. And we have every intention of taking that on, but even if it's just recording something that then played there, you know, that'll be said in one way or the other.
Well, hopefully we get to see you take it to the intellectual woodshed this week. Any other final thoughts where you want to direct people? Obviously, you got your website, Murder by Decree, and you got your radio show on Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Murderbydecree.com, that's where you can find a lot. And I think you've got the postings of the radio show and all that
other
stuff.
Yep.
I would just say first thing is to educate ourselves and learn and write to me, thecommonland@gmail.com, and I'll answer you back. We'll carry it on. And I appreciate the show today. I think it went really deep, and I had really fun talking to you today. So.
Oh, likewise, Mr. Annett. Yeah, it was kind of one of those free flow, go with the flow shows.
Yeah,
so I think it went well. And thanks to the audience, of course. We'll see everybody next time, folks. Stay frosty.